Hello, writers, cowboys, cowgirls, cowpokes, and cowpoets, and welcome to another edition of Right Minded. I'm here with my co-host, Brooke Warner, and I have no idea what Brooke's relationship to living life on the range is, but I'm riffing on all of this because our guest today is Pam Houston, who is widely celebrated for being a master of the short form, and her first book, a true classic that landed her on the map, was a collection of short stories titled Cowboys Are My Weakness. And in her latest book, the memoir Deep Creek, which is a collection of interlinked essays, she says that she's her own cowboy, which I take to mean as an assertion of self-sufficiency. She's certainly self-sufficient because she lives on and manages a ranch on the Continental Divide in Colorado. And Brooke, Pam is one of those authors who I'm envious of because I like that idea of living in the expanse of a Colorado or Montana, but I also know it's not as easy as it looks. And her memoir reveals plenty of tough living. I think a lot of writers idealize living in remote places and they seek them out for creative sustenance. I know I've fantasized about living in the most banded places in the world to write. Have you ever wanted to live in a more rural or remote place, especially for creative reasons?
You know, every once in a while I think about moving someplace less crowded, but when those fantasies come up for me, they're like moving to Point Reyes or Tamales Bay, which, as you know, is like an hour from where we live. So no, it's never occurred to me actually to live in a more remote place, and certainly not a rural place. I am very much a city girl, and I grew up in the suburbs, and I always wanted to go bigger rather than smaller. But it is curious to me how many writers do go rural, and I can totally understand that impulse, you know, to move towards something more quiet, more conducive to writing, or at least it seems to me that it would be the case that those things would be true. And in my world, I think because of book publishing, I'm interested in being close to cultural centers. And if I could move someplace right now, it would probably be to New York to be closer to my girlfriend, which is hardly more rural. But, you know, you, on the other hand, Grant, grew up in a small town and now you're in Berkeley. So have you ever gone more rural, wanted to?
Yeah, I flirt with it a lot. And I've had a couple moments when I've actually done this, perhaps most notably when I spent a summer in a little house in the Gila wilderness. I was house sitting, though, so I wasn't in charge of anything beyond painting a garage for the summer, and I barely got that done. And so my main hardship that summer was really just not having much money. I wasn't tending flocks of sheep or anything like that. I did get a lot of writing done that summer, though, and I think the scenery and the timeless expanse of the days fed me creatively. And I often think there's, you know, I don't know how American authors compare with other nations' authors, but there is this desire to go to remote places that often, you know, takes place with authors. And I think of Wendell Berry, whose writing is so tied to his life as a farmer on the land, and his family, you know, has farmed for generations in Kentucky on that farm, or Jim Harrison, who wrote about characters in the sparsely populated West and lived in Arizona and Montana, or Mary Oliver, who was she patrolled the wetlands around Provincetown and wrote about nature. That was place was very important to her. And I think Pam Houston is very much in that same tradition. It's interesting to me because Pam Houston bought the ranch on a lark with a $21,000 advance she got for her first book. And she says she dared herself to do it. She didn't come from a ranch background at all, which is super impressive. But she's spent most of her life there now. And she has the notion that the land has taken care of her as much as she's taken care of it. She says that life on the ranch is a meditation in stillness, in fact, and that she gets so much of her inspiration from just looking out her kitchen window or staring up at the snow-covered mountains. And coincidentally, I just saw this show on PBS, or just part of a show, and they were profiling a writing residency, and the house was just a little shack. I'm not even sure where it was. It looked like some, you know, kind of something near the ocean on a beach, but it didn't have electricity. It only had an outhouse, and they had all kinds of famous authors who had gone there and written during their residency there. And they were, you know, they interviewed one person who was just rhapsodizing about how she was able to go so much deeper into her work without electricity and in such a setting. And so I imagine Pam's setting provides a similar type of nourishment, which to me sounds really nice.
Yeah, it definitely does. And it does make me wonder about her approach to writing. When we get into the interview, I was struck by how Pam talked about Deep Creek initially was just going to be about the ranch, and it kind of wasn't enough. And it's not surprising because Pam has a very curious mind, a beautiful writing style, a knack for observation. And like you said, she's also famous for these short pieces. And she's written two collections of short stories, A Little More About Me is the collection of essays. And then her new memoir, which you mentioned, is an interlinking series of essays, but it was positioned and sold as a memoir. And so, in fact, you know, I think about form a lot, and especially about memoir, because I like to think about saleability and because authors ask me about it. And it's really difficult, in fact, to get collections of essays published. And so when I think about how it is to write these and how, you know, most of the time authors are publishing essays on online outlets and literary journals and for anthologies, and that Pam set out to write a memoir, and it's a continuous book project in a sense, and yet it also intentionally does this cohesive narration in short essays. So I'm just interested in the subject in general. I think the publishing world feels about books of essays the way it feels about poetry, which is that it's super hard to sell them. I believe this is true for collections of short stories, and I'm not really sure why, you know, because on the one hand, I think collections like these and essays and books of short stories are revered. It's also the case that they're kind of reserved for already famous writers. And so writers who are just starting out are generally advised against even trying. And I wonder if you have heard this, know this to be true, or what your take is on it, Grant.
Yeah, it's interesting because paradoxically, most fiction writers, most novelists, they kind of have to come up and build their careers by publishing short stories, at least initially. And they, especially in the literary fiction world, they have to really publish in certain literary journals to kind of, you know, prove their or get their street cred before they can go on to big publishers with their novels. And I don't know, it's I have different views because the other side of my life is what I call writing the short stuff and publishing it, because I run this little literary journal, 100-word story, which is all, you know, we publish 100-word stories, which are, you know, part of the flash fiction form. And I see that form really emerging, and it's becoming more and more popular, especially with younger writers. And I think this fits in, or it makes sense because of the internet. You know, like a little story fits into your stream on Facebook or Twitter, and just the little spaces that we write in on the internet, you know, encourage the kind of sensibility of small stories. And we live in a fragmentary age in a way, so short stories help express that. But I do know, like you said, bigger publishing houses are generally less likely to publish story collections. But I do see a lot of small presses embracing the form. And 8 years ago, when I started 100-word story, there were really just a handful of flash fiction journals around, and now there are just scores of them. It seems like I see a new one every other day. And there have been several new anthologies that have emerged that collect the best of the short form. So there's part of me that's hopeful that it's going to emerge. And I think that I also hope that publishers will see it as a trend and that they'll, you know, catch up to the trend. And I want to get your take on this as well, because I don't know, there's a notion out there that the essay is also reemerging. And I don't know if it's just because certain essayists have become prominent, like Leslie Jameson's very successful books. And then there are more hybrid collections, which I'm really interested in, by Claudia Rankin and Maggie Nelson. I know nothing about their sales figures, but it seems like somewhere somebody's hoping the essay is coming back.
I think it's a really interesting thing to dig into, because publishing trends change all the time. And you're totally right that there might be these very celebrated authors, and they can get away with something that the average first-time author will never get away with, right? You have to sometimes put yourself on the map first. And so I think that is a large part of it. So most essayists will start online. I mean, that's certainly where I read essays, mostly in the New Yorker, because I have a subscription. And I don't often buy collections, you know, unless I really, really love the author, which again is kind of proving the point. Like if the author has had success and a following and then compiles something, then his or her readers are going to buy that. So I did just pre-order Lydia Yuknovich's new book of stories, fiction called Verge. And that is because I really love her and I like her take on things. So I don't know. I'm more familiar with the essay, both as a reader and because I'm more immersed in the world of nonfiction publishing in my publishing career than I am with short stories and fiction. But I was doing a little looking into this and just remembering, because I knew this, that the word essay derives from the French infinitive essayé, to try or to attempt, which should lead us to more speculation about this form and what writers are actually trying to do when they write essay. And so I was poking around and I came across a New Yorker article by Vincent Cunningham about what makes an essay American. Kind of interesting. He wrote about how the essay is a direct outgrowth of the sermon. And in his words, they're argumentative, insistent, not infrequently irritating. And then Americans, in my observation, and despite our fetish for the beauties of individuality and personal freedom, are always, however smilingly, trying to convince somebody somewhere of something. And our essayistic tradition bears this out. I liked this, you know, because I never really thought about the heart of an essay being about trying to convince someone of something. But in my experience, that did ring true. And in my own experience of my own writing, that felt true. In Deep Creek, Pam is convincing us of a few things. You know, both of these are quotes from her book and speak to her themes. She says, to live simultaneously inside the wonder and the grief, to love the damaged world and do what I can to help it thrive. And then another quote that says, even if the jig is up, even if it really is game over, what better time to sing about the earth than when it is critically, even fatally wounded at our hands? And so I love that she's writing about her ranch as a place of stability, but also thoroughly questioning that stability the whole time, both internally and externally and existentially. And so it's a really powerful memoir, but it's also more than that. I did feel that she was doing all of the things, you know, the observing, the reckoning, the grappling with, sometimes arguing and insisting. And no matter what Pam is doing, though, she's doing it beautifully. So everybody, chew on that for a short bit, and we will be back with the indomitable Pam Houston. Hey everybody, looking for your next great read? Be sure to check out shereads.com. This community of women readers just celebrated its 2-year anniversary and hit over 1 million views. SheReads.com is the best place to get book recommendations based on your favorite authors, genres, TV shows, and movies. If you're listening to our podcast, you obviously love getting to know the authors behind some of the most incredible books. For more author exclusives and book recommendations, head over to SheReads.com, an incredible community of women writers. Don't know what to read next? SheReads has you covered there, too. With new articles, author interviews, and book recommendations coming out every day, SheReads brings readers all the bookish content you could want. Get your next book recommendation at SheReads.com.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. I'm super excited to introduce Pam Houston, who's going to join us. She is the author of the memoir, the recent memoir that just came out, Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country, as well as two novels, Contents May Have Shifted and Sighthound, and two collections of short stories, Cowboys Are My Weakness and Waltzing the Cat. And wait, there's more. And a collection of essays, A Little More About Me, all published by W.W. Norton. And her stories have won a slew of awards or been included into a lot of anthologies like the O. Henry Awards, the Pushcart Prize, Best American Travel Writing, and Best American Short Stories of the Century, among others. She teaches in the low-res MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts, and she's the professor of English at UC Davis and the co-founder and creative director of the literary nonprofit Writing by Writers. And she lives at 9,000 feet above sea level near the headwaters of the Rio Grande, so she's quite busy, obviously. Welcome, Pam.
Thank you. Thank you, Grant. Happy to be here.
We're super happy to have you. And just to give listeners a little background, I don't know how long ago it was, 30 or so years ago, that you received a $21,000 advance for your first book, the classic collection of short stories, Cowboys Are My Weakness. And you bought a ranch in Colorado. And it's this decision that informs every page of Deep Creek, your beautiful new memoir about writing and life in the American West. And in the book, you say that you could be your own cowboy, or that you are your own cowboy. What does that mean, especially as a tie between your first book and who you are now?
Yeah. Well, obviously that was an intentional callback to that first book, but more than that, it was a callback to the girl I was who came out West. You know, I grew up in New Jersey, deep in suburbia, and I came out West, right after college and fell completely in love with everything, the landscape, you know, the mountains, the rivers, the canyons. I was a river guide. I was a hunting guide, and also fell in love with the men. And as is made clear in Cowboys Are My Weakness, I somehow thought I had to impress the men, or I had to win over the men, or I had to do something that girl believed that, you know, the men were my access point to the West, the Western men, who some of them were transplants themselves, of course, but the hunting guides and the fishing guides and the river guides, and, you know, fell in love with a series of them and that went how it went. But I think, you know, the years of having my own place taught me that I could have a direct relationship with the West, even though I'm from New Jersey. And, you know, even though I'm always learning about it and learning how to be in it, you know, that caring for the ranch and making the ranch my own just made me understand that I didn't need a man to translate that landscape for me, that I was in it. You know, I was having a relationship with it.
I love that description. And I think it's so important for people to kind of take on as their own a little bit and think about how they might be the cowboys in their own lives, because I certainly want to be or imagine myself to be. And, you know, Grant and I like to talk about the interesting lines and intersections between fiction and nonfiction, between novels and memoirs, and in your case, also between story and essay. And you're the perfect author for us in so many ways because of that. And you once said, "Everything I write is 87% true." And at the time, you'd written a lot of autobiographical fiction and essays. So now that you have this memoir, is that saying still true? Like, is it 87% true? And does that rule apply for fiction and nonfiction, or would you revise it now?
I would revise it now for a lot of reasons, you know, not the least of which is Donald Trump and fake news and like all the kinds of trouble that slide between, you know, who gets to tell what story and what really happened. You know, that's sort of gotten our profession into trouble, not to mention the world. It is true that all of my fiction has a strong autobiographical element. In Deep Creek, it wasn't so much that I tried harder to tell the truth, although I did. You know, I really said, okay, just set yourself the challenge. Like, don't embellish, you know, don't make it funnier than it really was. Don't make it colder than it really was. You know, just see what happens if you have to stay to the truth. Now, it's my belief system, and I've written about this several places, you know, that language can't represent reality. So I don't believe anyone who says, oh yeah, my memoir is 100% true. I think that's impossible. I think that's impossible because of the failure of memory. I think it's impossible because of language's inability to mean, and the fact that meaning occurs at the junction of code and context is always changing. You know, our words don't stand still. So I think there's a lot of reasons why a memoir, no matter how hard you try, can't be like 100% accurate or true or real. You know, we're all telling stories all the time and they morph when we tell them. That said, in Deep Creek, I tried really hard to just have my life described unadorned. You know, I wasn't playing literary tricks in Deep Creek. I wasn't embellishing. I wasn't thinking as hard about story arc as I was about simply, I said to myself the whole time I was writing it, write deeply into the pasture, you know, just like let the meaning of this place rise up through the details and don't shape them, you know. So I kind of think of this book, not so much that it's 100% true or 90% true, it's definitely less shaped and less storyized, you know, than my other work. It's letting the details of my life rise up and tell the story.
Well, Pam, you've called Deep Creek a book of interlocking essays, and I love its structure, this almanac idea mm-hmm. that you had, because I'm very interested in structure and how writers devise a container for their work. So can you tell us more about what draws you to the short form in general, even if in this case they're of a piece?
Sure. And also about how the almanacs came to be, I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah, that would be great.
Because, well, first of all, I'll say that no matter what I'm writing, even if it's a book review, you know, anything that I'm assembling, I always think of it as a bunch of powerful or impactful tiny pieces that come together and make bigger pieces that come together and make bigger pieces. I mean, you know, these books of mine that are called novels, they could be called story collections, or they could be called, you know, linked personal essays. You know, I'm always writing in between genres, and part of that is because my writing's autobiographical, but another part of it is because I always see work as a series of small pieces. I call them glimmers when I teach, but small impactful moments or objects or scenes that come together in an unusual way to make more than the sum of their parts. That's basically my writing project. So with Deep Creek, it always helps me to have a form when I get started. The form of my last book, Contents May Have Shifted, was a 12-sided Rubik's Cube. That's just an idea I hold in my head that helps me write. In this case, I wanted the form to be a calendar because the ranch is nothing if not a calendar. You know, that's what it is. It's, you have to get your hay in the barn by this date. You have to get your wood on the porch by this date. The lambs come on this date. You know, the pasture melts on this date. Pipes freeze on this date. You know, it's, anyone who ranches or who even pretends at ranching the way I do, sort of, you know, anyone who owns a piece of property in a place where the weather is extreme lives and dies by the calendar. So the first couple of years of writing Deep Creek, I was banging my head against the wall trying to make it a calendar, like trying to make it a literal calendar, like chapter one, January, chapter two, February, chapter three, you know, and I couldn't do it for the life of me. I couldn't make it work. And so I finally had to just let it go and be sort of formless for a year, which is my least favorite situation. I hate that. I hate not having a form, because the form gets me to the page. It gets me to the computer. It says, okay, what are the size of the boxes I'm filling today? And then I feel happy. But if I don't have that, I just feel a little lost. But I thought, okay, well, you don't know how to write this book, so just put some words on a page. So I did that for a year. But then in a way that made me really, really happy, the calendar came back. It came back in the form of those almanac pieces. And by that time, the book had changed so much, and I had added my childhood, and I had added climate change and all these other things. And so it really, the calendar wasn't going to work anymore. But those almanac pieces kind of fell out of the other essays. There were kind of all these little pieces that I couldn't make work in the essays, but all of a sudden I saw them and I saw what they were. And, you know, I always say that if your subconscious doesn't show up to the writing party, you're not really writing. And I think my subconscious was taking care of that idea of the calendar all those years I was in despair, because the almanac sort of just showed up right at the last minute. And it was like, oh, these are the interstitial pieces between the larger chapters, and it's my calendar, because they do go in order. Not that anyone really cares about this stuff except me, but
I care. I appreciate the process on the structure, because I do think a lot of memoirists sit there trying to figure out how to make something work that's more interesting than simply, I'm just putting this out there for you to look at.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I do think because we're all a little insecure about, like, why would anybody care about my story? Form really helps validate that, because I believe that the reader can feel the form, can feel the integrity of the form, even if they don't see it.
You know, when I was preparing for this interview and taking notes on my computer, I had a typo and I wrote the word member instead of memoir. Oh. And I like to be in this state where I pursue the accidental to see where it leads. Sure. So is a memoir like an extra member of your family? And if so, is it a different kind of family member than a work of fiction?
Yes, it would be like the sister who was never as pretty as the other sisters and maybe not as talented or as smart. Like suddenly, like she met the really great partner and they got married and had a wonderful life. Like it's kind of like that. It's like the unadorned, the sister who never had it easy. Got her say, you know, kind of.
So in Deep Creek, you circle a paradox, which is how to live fully in the moment with gratitude, but you're also contending with such real threats. I mean, past and present, particularly in the present with your commentary on climate change. And as a person who's also deeply concerned about the climate. I mean, most people, I hope, are. But I appreciated how you wrote about it, because it's not about solutions. It's saying we're here, we have to own this huge problem that we've created. And I guess I'm wondering if you had any choice but to write about climate change. Like, the question I wanted to ask you is, did you set out to be a voice grappling with the impact of climate change, or was it just your lived experience that made it so pressing for you in this new body of work?
You know, it was the way that happened when I proposed this book, you know, eight years ago now, we all, meaning my agent, my editor, myself, we all sort of decided this was going to be all ranch all the time. It was only going to be about the ranch. It was going to be a year in Provence in Colorado, we called it. And then I wrote that book, and none of us liked it. You know, it was really only the ranch stuff. And my agent said to me, isn't this the book where you talk about what happened to you as a child? And my response to that was, God, have I done anything else my entire life? It seems like all I've been doing. She's like, no, you haven't. You haven't written it in the same plain spoken way you've written about baling hay, you know? And so I thought, okay, well, I can do that. And so I added that. And then, you know, over the course of that 7 years of working on the book, climate change became a lot more present to us, you know, to all of us, certainly to me. And I started to wake up in the morning thinking about it and going to bed at night scared about it and sad about it, in grief about it. And I thought, well, here I am writing this book about my little piece of paradise at 9,000 feet, you know, in one of the last valleys that's going to go underwater. Like, maybe this book should be addressing that too. I do think it's possible to be joyful about every beautiful thing we see in nature and hold that right next to the grief and the responsibility. Because if we don't take responsibility, even in our hearts, you know, regardless of whether we can help or change or make better or delay, if we don't take responsibility, like, we're not, you know, we're not living the right life, you know, for what we've done.
Well, Pam, in closing, you know, when I was preparing for this interview and I read that you were worried about the story being boring, I was quite startled, because, you know, your life is in so many ways more exciting than mine. And I was like wondering how you could possibly think that. And we've talked about how the difference between storyizing content or not storyizing it, I guess. Was it something more? Was the right? I always think about how when I fear that my writing's boring, it's always at a moment of great self-doubt that I'm not really believing in myself as much as I should. So was there a moment where you really had to kind of embrace the story, embrace yourself and tell yourself, this is great, this is good content to explore?
You know, that's not kind of how it goes for me. There's always little things, you know, there's always little moments, for sure. I know the book is full of moments. Little tiny moments, little tiny glimmers, like I talked about before, that I knew were worth writing, you know what I mean? And that are worth reading. Like that's where my confidence comes from. That's what I have confidence in. But I don't ever say, yeah, damn it, this is a good story and it deserves to be told. I don't ever get there. It was just a matter of, like, and it's really the same question I ask in all my books, is there enough of these glimmers, you know, which is why I believe in this method. Like, if all the little pieces of my raw materials are good, the whole almost can't help but be good, right? But I felt in this one, it just might be too slow, you know, right deeply into the pasture. Like, that was like a blessing and a curse.
Well, here's the following the glimmers of your story. Thanks so much for being with us, Pam.
Thanks so much, Pam.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you guys so much.
All right, folks, we will be right back with Grant's Takeaway.
Hey, everyone, welcome back. And today's takeaway is sort of a riff off of her comments about her fear of being boring in her memoir, and also what she said about storyizing her stories or her memoir. And that decision that we have between writing fiction or writing something as nonfiction. And she said that when she storyized her fiction, she could bring in a lot of really exciting elements. She could take liberties with it. She didn't have to just let it be boring if she was bored by it. And sometimes our nonfiction, we can't take those liberties. She wants to be 100% truthful and accurate in nonfiction. So part of that storyizing is presenting a dramatic scene and engaging people in the dialogue and the drama of the scene. And she was worried about being boring because she felt like she was telling so much. And so I'd like you just to kind of experimenting with that showing and telling. It's like one of the first principles of writing, right? Show, don't tell. And take a scene from your life, a moment from your life that you find interesting, and write it once in the third person with a lot of showing and dramatic elements. You know, think about presenting it on stage, essentially. And then take the same scene and write it as if you're telling it. If you're telling it to a friend as a story, telling it over dinner. And see how the two different versions change the nature of what you're writing, whether you see it as boring or as exciting, or if it affords different possibilities. Think about whether one leads more to presenting the story as fiction or as nonfiction. It'll open up different takes on the same scene.
Well, thanks for that, Grant. And thank you, everyone, for listening to our podcast, for being a fan, for sharing with your friends. We really appreciate all of that and helping us to spread the word. You guys already know, because you're listening, that you can download this anywhere you get your podcasts. But maybe this week you could tell a new friend about it, someone who's working on a new project and or who is just a reader and who might be excited about some of our guests. Again, thank you. We'll see you next week.